Okay, so what I want to talk about today, this is a sort of summer session, and we're just in a way, those of us who are sort of teaching this class, just have the opportunity to talk about something that we want to talk about, I suppose. There's not a particular theme going on for summer. And so I thought I particularly would like to talk about this teaching, because it's one that I find very personally inspiring and energising, and also because it links in a bit. We've had quite a long session in which various order members have talked about their relationship to their teacher and what that means to them, and I think that this links in for me with that theme as well. What I want to talk about is a teaching which is part of, as I said, the Lam Rim, it's called, or the Stages of the Path, or sometimes called the Four Reminders or Four Mind-Turning Reflections. And they're reflections, they're objects that you take and contemplate and reflect upon in order to, I suppose, increase your kind of energy for practice. And there's four of them, as I said, and I'll just tell you to start with what they are. I'm only talking about the first one. But the four reflections are, first of all, the precious opportunity offered by human life, that we have a human life, that precious opportunity. The second is the fact of death and impermanence, that all that we have is constantly changing. You can't rely on it, and it's a spur to practice. The third of these is what's called karma, or more sort of, I suppose, in English, the fact that actions have consequences, that we have responsibility for our ethical lives, and we can create a better life for ourselves, a better state of mind for ourselves by the way we act and behave. And the fourth of them is the disadvantages of what's called samsara, the disadvantages of worldly life, I suppose, the suffering that there is in worldly life. And all of these, in a way, they're not sort of statements about this is the way things are. They're more things to reflect upon, to kind of create an effect, to create the spur to practice. So what I want to talk about is the precious human life, or the precious human body. And I'm going to introduce that through the very traditional teaching as it appears in many Buddhist scriptures on, you know, how that's formulated. But I want to sort of just bring in my own reflections. I'm not going to go into the whole teaching, because there's a lot to it. That would be a whole study seminar. I just want to bring out a few points that I find personally interesting and hopefully helpful. But I want to be a bit autobiographical here, because I want to take us back to 1982, May 1982, which I just looked up to see what was happening in 1982. Apparently the first home computer was launched.
Wow.
Margaret Thatcher had been Prime Minister for the first three of her 11 years, and the Falklands War had just started, so that time. Apparently, the European Court of Human Rights had just banned caning in schools, and Canada had just gained full independence. It all feels quite recent, but no, it's actually a bit more historic. Yeah. That's a long time ago. My sons were 7 and 5, and I had been a Mitra for a couple of years. And I was invited to go on a study seminar with Sangharakshita. At that time, all Mitras got the opportunity to go on study seminars. That didn't happen. You know, that was, in a way, in the early days of the movement, there was that opportunity. And this study seminar was on a particular text, which is Gampopa's Dual Ornament of Liberation. And Sangharakshita, or Bante, as we call him, his comment at the start was, he's sure we were all quite familiar with that work, and no, it was new to me. So during this study seminar, we were studying this text for 3 hours every morning for 10 days. And I went into this in a way with a sort of feeling of like, oh, this is going to go well, because I was quite confident, intellectually confident, and done well at school. I thought I would do well. I immediately felt I was way out of my depth, and was being presented with these teachings, which in a way I could understand to a certain extent, but I felt that there was so much more depth to them than I could then understand. And I suppose what I'd say is that 10 days was a really crucial time in my life, where I think I received the teachings that would see me through the rest of my life. I think that if I were to in any way be able to fully realise, put into practice what I heard in those 10 days, you know, that would have been sufficient. And it's as if that those 10 days laid the ground for my Dharma life, my whole Dharma life. And nowadays I often find myself going back to that seminar and you know, just sort of seeing things a bit more deeply, a bit more experientially, I suppose. Yeah, so this seminar was on the dual ornament of liberation. It was on a particular chapter of the dual ornament of liberation, which is called the working basis. And the working basis, according to Gampopa, is the human body. Our human life is the working basis for the whole of the spiritual life. And so one of the things that made a very immediate impression on me was that during this seminar we got into a discussion about one of the teachings, which was a discussion of Buddha nature. And I found that Sangharakshita was questioning Gampopa's teaching. He said he thought what Gampopa was saying was a bit misleading, and he wouldn't put it that way, he would say it this way. Now, I don't want to get into the actual content of the teaching, but what I remember was this was really exciting, in that it made a huge impression that here was this book, which was in a sense sort of holy scripture, I suppose, you know, and Bhante was saying, yeah, well, I'm not sure about that. And so he was disagreeing with him at certain points, and I had almost a sense of two great teachers having a debate, you know, across time and space, you know, Gampopa putting one side of the argument, Bhante putting the other side of the argument. And what that left me with was, what do I think then? You know, what that left me with was a sense of, I didn't have to take on board what Gampopa was saying. I could think, but I could also think critically about what Bhante was saying, which made the most impression on me, which made the most sense to me. And I think that if I were to say one of the things that I've gained from Sangharakshita, my years of being his disciple, which I am, it's that ability to look afresh at things, to look at the principles underlying things, and to really ask myself, does this make sense? Does this accord with experience? Which is the spirit of Buddhism, which in a sense goes way back to the Buddha. The Buddha said, test my words, like, what was it, a goldsmith tests gold? I can't remember the exact trade he referred to, but test my words in your experience. Yeah. So this body, the precious human body, is the working basis. And what Gampopa is saying is that we have this life as it appears to us right here and now, and we also have certain favourable conditions in which to practice the Dharma. So he pulls these conditions out. In the first place, we're born as a human being. Now this is an interesting place to start, because he goes into a list of other possible births that you could go through, and here they are. You could be born as an animal, as a hell being, as a heavenly being, a god, as a ghost, as one of the warring Asuras. Those are all, in traditional Buddhism, they seem very much as actual realms that you can be born into. You can take rebirth in one of those realms. But one of the things that Tangarakshana draws out particularly is that these are different states of mind which we can inhabit. We can be within one of those realms. We can be in a hell-like realm. And we can be in a heavenly realm. We can be in an aggressive realm, or a needy, craving realm, a ghost-like realm, or a realm of, I suppose, unawareness, a more sort of animal-like realm. Probably animals aren't that unaware, but just in a way, bringing out kind of states of mind that we can inhabit. But what Gampopa is saying, what Sangharakshita is saying, is that the human realm, in a way, is a realm that we can almost aspire to, or cultivate, or be able to cultivate more and more human states of mind. And the really, I suppose, a crucial part of that is that human beings, they have a certain amount of pain in their lives, and they have a certain amount of pleasure in their lives. It's not exclusively one thing or the other. I suppose an exclusively painful life is a hell realm. An exclusively pleasurable life is a heaven realm. And those are not seen as very favourable conditions to practice the Dharma. In a hell-like realm, you're simply caught up with the pain, with the need to survive. And in a heavenly realm, in some ways, when things are going very, very well for you, when you're sitting beside that infinity pool, sipping the cocktail, and, you know, in life is all going great, there's no particular spur to practice in that realm. There's no particular kind of grit in the oyster. And even more important, there's no particular, I suppose, awareness of suffering, and therefore no opportunity to develop compassion. Yeah. So in the human realm, there's this mix of pleasure and pain. There's this mix of different kinds of experience. And in the human realm, also, there's the ability, the awareness, to be able to reflect on those differences, on those conditions. Yeah. I just remember that poem of, I don't know if you know Blake's poem, The Auguries of Innocence, where he says, "It is right, it should be so. Man was made for joy and woe. And when this we rightly know, through the world we safely go." So there's joy and there's woe. And there's the ability to see that and reflect on it and be aware of our experience. But particularly aware of that experience in terms of what help us to be happy, and what help us to what causes us suffering. Yeah. So I do want to just at this point read you out what the traditional teaching is on the precious human life. Okay. And it's interesting because when you look at this teaching, it's a sort of it's not a neat and tidy list. There's a lot of overlap, and there's a lot of, the way I see it is it's as if the teacher is saying, well, this is really important. Oh, yes, and this is really important. And, well, that thing I said earlier, that was really important, so I'm going to say it again in a different way. So don't expect a neat and tidy list. But this is the teaching on the precious human life is one which has the eight freedoms in the first place. So it's freedom from birth in the five unfavourable realms in the first place. So in all of these unfavourable realms, in hell, as a ghostly being, as an animal, as a god, or in a warring area. It's freedom from having wrong views about reality. So I'm going to go into that a bit later. It's freedom from being born where no Buddha has appeared in this particular world. It's freedom from being born without senses enough to understand the Dharma. So it's the fact that we have enough faculties, we can hear, we can see, can understand the Dharma. So then the 10 endowments, there's the 8 freedoms, the 10 endowments. So the 10 endowments are to be born as a human, as we've said already. In a central country, that's to say in a country where there's sufficient sort of stability to and civilization, to that our lives are not a constant struggle for survival. It's being born with senses enough to understand the Dharma. It's being born in a relatively positive ethical status, so not having committed what's called in Buddhism the heinous deeds, which are, well, I think there's killing one's parents. I'm not going to go into the whole list, but matricide, patricide, wounding a Buddha, you know, that things which are karmically a heavy burden to carry. It's having confidence in the three jewels, in the three refuges, the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. It's being born where a Buddha has appeared, same thing as previous, being free from being born where no Buddha has appeared. It's being born where the Dharma has been taught. It's being born in stable conditions where the Dharma is flourishing. It's being born where there is a Sangha. And it's being born with compassion, having compassion. So that's the traditional teaching. And as I say, I do want to draw out a few points from these and not go into them all in depth. So this idea about being free from wrong views about reality. This is something I want to talk about a bit. There's quite a nice quote from Goethe that I came across recently. He said, "We more readily confess to errors, mistakes and shortcomings in our conduct than in our thought. And the reason for this is that the conscience is humble, but the intellect is proud." I really think that's good. I think that's really good and true. It's more easy for us to say, sorry, you know, I got angry or something like that, and to say, actually, when I had that view, I may have been a bit mistaken, or I may have not got that quite, you know. We tend to hold to our views often more strongly than we hold to our, I suppose, daily kind of misdemeanors, I suppose, or unkindnesses and things like that. And the Buddha specified what he meant by wrong views. And I just want to look at two of those. One of them is that there are no good and virtuous recluses in the world who have realized for themselves by direct knowledge. And the other is that there is no fruit or result of good or bad actions. So these are two very basic views that the Buddha undermined with his teaching. The very first one, it's the language maybe needs a bit of explaining. There are no good or virtuous recluses in the world who have realized themselves by direct knowledge. That's to say, there is nobody in the world who has realized insight or realized enlightenment. Or perhaps to say that the possibility of a state beyond our everyday human life is not possible. That there's just what the world presents to our senses, and that's it. That there's not a possibility for enlightenment. And yeah, the Buddha, in a way, he saw that as one of the most limiting views that we could have. That this is all there is. There's nothing more to it. So maybe this is just something to reflect on. That how do we become aware of or convinced that there's a possibility of going beyond our everyday mind, going beyond and attaining what the Buddha described as enlightenment, or maybe insight or awakening? I think there are various ways of approaching this. I think there's possibly the way of looking at people who perhaps are further down the path than us, and seeing that there are people who are more developed than ourselves, there are people who are more aware, who are wiser, who are kinder, who exemplify qualities that, in a way, are still, you know, we're still developing. And I think we can think of such people, and we can also witness in ourselves and in friends that we change. I think this is something that's very immediate. If we start practicing the teachings, if we start meditating, if we start studying the Dharma, if we start reflecting, if we start communicating with other people who have similar values, we see ourselves and each other changing. And all that the Buddha is saying is that there's no limit to that potential within us. We can continue going on changing. There isn't a point where we need to stop. We can always become wiser. We can always become kinder. We see that that is a living possibility. Sometimes it's easier to see it in other people than in ourselves. I think, in fact, it's a lot easier to see it in other people than ourselves. And that's something that came up on a retreat that I was on recently. Vasantra was teaching. Somebody asked the question about how to have confidence. You know, you might think, well, enlightenment might be a possibility for other people because they're good at it, but me? No, I know myself too well. I know that's out of the question. And so somebody asked him, how do you develop the confidence that, you know, that confidence is possible? And he suggests not trying to just build self-confidence, not trying to build oneself up. But he said building confidence in the Dharma, building confidence in the teaching, really reflecting on that. And he said that the more you build that confidence, the more you think, well, what's so special about me? Why am I, you know, so specially awful that what's possible for others isn't possible for me? So in a way, faith in one's own ability to attain insight is by extension a faith in the Dharma, a faith in the teaching. So secondly, the wrong view that the Buddha wants to undermine is that there is no fruit or result of good and bad actions. And this is the view that it doesn't matter how we behave. Whatever happens in our mind or whatever we do is somehow random, and it doesn't depend on our past. It doesn't have an effect in the future. In some ways, I think that this is quite a kind of nihilistic modern point of view. I think now that people no longer believe in the old theistic rewards and punishments sort of model that, you know, reason to be good is to go to heaven, that sort of thing. There's a certain sort of feeling, well, why be good? Why be ethical? Good in, I suppose, the real sense, good in the ethical sense. It doesn't matter, you know. But I think it doesn't take much reflection on our experience to notice that what we do affects us. You know, our mental states affect us. And if, for example, we're untruthful about something, there's a discomfort that arises in our being. I don't know if anybody's seen that film Inside Out. Anybody seen that yet? Okay. It's sort of neuroscience for kids sort of film. But there was this point where there are all these kind of islands in this child's brain, you know, the inside of her mind. There was the island of happiness, goofiness, the island of hockey, the island of this. And there was this island called the island of truthfulness. And all of these contributed to her well-being. And in the film, it was quite interesting. There was a point where all of a sudden, under extreme duress, she told a lie. And this island of truthfulness suddenly crumbled, and actually the whole the whole ground of her mind sort of it was like a huge earthquake. And I thought that somehow the filmmakers had got a point there. They'd sort of cottoned onto something, that you know, untruthfulness actually really upset her being in a way some of the other islands hadn't, you know, their kind of destruction hadn't. I thought it was really interesting. Actions have consequences. I think they'd got the point that, you know, actions have or thoughts have consequences. Okay. But this whole area of karma, ethical action, is one that I think that there are just many, many levels to it. There are levels of ethical practice. It's not just a simple matter of following a few good rules to lead a good life, but it's something that goes deeper and deeper. And I want to use an example. Apologies if I've used it before, but this was quite a sort of point where I really saw something on a retreat. I was on a retreat, and it was a retreat on the subject of ethics, so obviously I was reflecting on that a lot. And I just noticed that I have a tendency, when I'm on retreat, to be a bit mentally grumbly and a bit sort of, grumbly about, don't quite like the food, or it's a long way to go to the toilet at night, or, I've got to get up early next morning, just this slight grumbly state. And because I was an ethics retreat, I thought, you know what, this is, contentment is actually a matter of ethics. It's a matter of, something is something you can cultivate. And so I chose that I would try to dwell on my good fortune being on retreat. I would try and dwell on what was enjoyable and pleasurable, and I would not give any space to this like grumbliness. So that was good. That was good. That worked at a certain level. But in spotting that inner monologue, I realised it was quite a habit. And the more I reflected on it, I realised that I spend a lot of time thinking about what I like and what I don't like in my experience, and thinking about, I like this and I don't like that, and not only that, I realised that I was slightly proud of my likes and dislikes. I'm the sort of person that likes crosswords but doesn't like sports. I like, this kind of food, I don't like that kind of food. And somehow there's a way in which I'm building a sense of myself on these likes and dislikes all the time. I'm telling myself I'm this kind of person, I like this and I don't like that. And it's reinforcing a kind of view of myself or personality. And I almost began to feel that what I call myself, or self, is just this bundle of likes and dislikes that's constantly kind of driving me. And so I took another precept at that point, which was that I would notice and desist from dwelling on what I like and what I don't like. And I must say, having gone back to this talk, I gave this talk in a retreat, having gone back to this talk and reminding myself of that, I thought, oh, I've really slipped with that and I really need to go back to that, But it's a very interesting exercise to sort of continually catch myself looking at what do I like, what do I not like, and what self-view is being sort of cultivated through that. So I think that's just one example of cultivating ethics, and in that it starts at a particular level of noticing a particular unskillful mental state or habit or whatever. But the more you notice, the more you reflect on them. It's almost like they're a kind of like a hair in the plug hole. You pull on them, and more and more and more comes out. You see more and more about yourself. So another thing I want to bring out from this teaching of Gampopa's is that something that repeatedly comes up in these lists of the freedoms and the endowments is that it's important to be in contact with the Buddha the Dharma and the Sangha are important. There's the good fortune of being in an era where the Buddha has, well, there was a Buddha within our historical time, that he taught the Dharma, that there is a Sangha that we can practice with. And I think that this is something which is sort of emphasising over and over again. Gampopa is emphasising over and over again what extreme good fortune we have in this, being in these conditions. So why emphasise this so much? I think that one of the reasons is because we are incredibly conditioned beings. We're beings who are very susceptible to the conditions that we put ourselves in. We know that, those of you who've been on retreat, it's as if you've walked into a world where you can simply, you know, be in contact with the Dharma, be with other people who are practicing. Our minds start to change, our mental states start to change. It feels like a kind of magic that's happening. But it's because we're subject to conditions. We're subject to the conditions we put ourselves in. And knowing this, then there's a choice. What conditions do we put ourselves in? You know, what do we expose our minds to? What's helpful and what's not helpful? You know, I suppose there's an awful lot of stimuli that we can expose ourselves to in life these days. Vast amount, isn't there? The internet's full of it, you know. And how do we choose what to, you know, what helps us to, you know, experience more positive, more fruitful states of mind? We have the choice to put ourselves in those conditions. So I think the whole point of this teaching on the precious human life is to act as an encouragement that we have really, really good conditions. I think that if I were to think about, you know, the places in the planet that I could be living, you know, there are many places in the planet which it would be very difficult to have this kind of freedom, to have this kind of these kind of conditions. And I suppose that is a bit like, I think it's a bit like, think of a child of a poor family who has the opportunity to receive an education, then will want to go back and help their people, their community. I was thinking of the teacher Ambedkar, who was born as a, well, not the teacher, so the where he was part of the Indian first Indian government. In fact, he was a lawyer, politician. But he was born into an untouchable family and grew up with that, I suppose, that stigma of caste. But was a very bright and very, very motivated child who sat outside the classroom so that he could hear the lessons, because he wasn't allowed within the classroom to contaminate the caste Hindus. He went to university. He had all of those advantages. And so, well, he made those advantages in his life. He certainly wasn't born into good conditions. But his motivation was to go back and to help his community, the ex-untouchables, and lead them out of what he described as the hell of caste. So I think reflecting on the good conditions we have, it's not enough just to think, I have great conditions and that lucky me. It's how do I then share those? How do I, you know, make those conditions more available to others? Yeah. There's this saying that even in the hell realms, according to the Buddhist teaching, one compassionate thought dispels the hell realms. I think that means in terms of our own mental states. Compassion is the key to dispelling those mental states. So, I think I'd like to stop there And I think I'd like maybe to have a little opportunity for you to sort of reflect on a few questions yourselves. Maybe you could get into little groups of three or four, and I'll give you these questions to reflect on. I should have written them down, or written them on a board. In fact, I could write them on a board, couldn't I? I'll do that. Here are the questions I'd like you to reflect on. First of all, how do I feel about my body? You know, what's my response to my body? Particularly, I suppose, as an opportunity, you know, as the life that I've got as an opportunity. Okay. The second question is, can I respond to the possibility that there are those who have attained liberation? And thirdly, do I seek to create better conditions for practice? And maybe what might those be? So there's three questions, and maybe you won't have time to look at all of them, but maybe one of them jumps out at you. Okay. How do I respond to the possibility that there are those who've attained liberation, that liberation is possible? Okay. So maybe if you just get into little groups of three or four. Okay. I haven't had a chance to talk about all of those, but anyway, you can take them away and reflect on them. I just suggest that we maybe just finish with just a short sort of period of sitting, and we can chant as well. So since we've been looking quite a bit at the theme of body, it's just a time to just come back, gather ourselves, recontact, grounding ourselves in our body. We could chant the Shakyamuni mantra after a minute or two. So I'll lead that. The mantra of the Buddha. Muni Muni Maha Muni Shakya Muni Swaha. Om Muni Muni Maha Muni Shakya Muni Swaha. Om Muni Muni Maha Muni Shakya Muni Swaha. Oh.
Ni Swaha. Om Muni Muni Maha Muni Shakya Muni.